Coming up on episode 412 of Wheel Bearings, we've got the Toyota Grand Highlander Nightshade, the Toyota Crown Signia, another update on Nicole's Jeep Wagoneer S. Lucid sort of gets supercharger support for the Air. Honda and Acura get supercharger access for their EVs. The new Honda Prelude's getting the Type R suspension system, and the Acura TLX is no longer with us. 250,000 miles on a Mach-E, and it still has 92% of its battery capacity. $200,000 for an Acura Integra? All that and more coming up next. This is episode 412 of Wheel Bearings. I'm Sam Abul Samad from Telemetry.
And I am Nicole Weakland from, let's go with AutoWeb this week.
And unfortunately, Robbie's having a family emergency that he's dealing with, so he's not with us this morning. And actually, as it turns out, you weren't supposed to be here today either.
No, originally I was not going to be here, so I guess it's good that it worked out. Shall we talk about the adventure that led me to being home
right into that.
This Sunday morning? Okay, so Friday I was supposed to be flying to Washington, D.C., and I got to the airport and I parked my personal Jeep Wagoneer S. I parked it. It was about 90% charged. I plugged it in at the official chargers in the central parking garage at Logan Airport. It was happily charging. I even got a notification saying, hey, hey, your car's finished charging. Because I sat in the airport for 5 hours, roughly, before they finally canceled my flight. And couldn't make it work. So hubby and I marched back out to the car, and I opened the car door, and guess what?
You got in, started up, and drove home, and everything was good.
That would have been the case scenario that I was hoping for. However, instead I got in and my car is dead again. Is dead. Is dead as a doornail. In on the sixth floor of the central parking garage at Logan Airport at approximately 9 p.m. on a Friday night. I can't open the tailgate. I can't. So here's the thing. So like I'm thinking, okay, my 12 volts gone again, which has me cranky because what the heck, right? So to get out of the parking garage at Logan Airport, you can't have a tow truck come into the garage. Only Massport, who's the official transportation, they're going to handle all this stuff, is allowed to tow from a Massport-owned garage. So what I had to do was call AAA to meet in the Hilton Airport Hotel parking lot and have Massport tow the car out to the flatbed that was taking it home. Now, wait, hold. You can't just tow an EV like a normal car. You have to have the flatbed. So what does one do? You put on these little dollies. I have now experienced two new towing options due to my Wagoneer S not being happy. First, little skid thingies they put under it to yank it out of the garage a couple of weeks ago. And now the dollies. Okay. So we have this all ready to go. And now before we get to the point, it was 2 hours to wait for AAA to come and tow the car. I also reached out to Jeep's roadside assistance because the car is new and I have that because I was in Boston and I don't want it towed to Boston. I want it towed home to the dealership I deal with up here. Fun fact, they will only tow it to the nearest dealership to where your car is broken down. Do you know how much it would cost to tow the car from Boston to Nashua?
I'm going to say $300.
$456.12. And I said, no, thank you. I'll rely on my AAA membership. So, honest personal plug.
But AAA usually won't tow that far.
You can have on your AAA. There's like AAA and then AAA Plus, I think it is.
Oh, you got the premium.
And I have the premium one. So if I ever broke down in the middle of nowhere or whatever, and because the girls were on it for the longest time. So I've had AAA Plus forever. Thank you, AAA, for not charging me $456.12 to take my car to Nashua, New Hampshire, to where the Allen Mello Dodge dealership that I use is. So, so I'm waiting. And in the meantime, now I'm with Russ, thankfully, because otherwise I'm in a parking garage at Logan Airport in the dark at 9 o'clock at night by myself with a car that won't go. Okay. So now Russ is like, well, there's got to be a way to get the tailgate open and access this 12 volt, blah, blah, blah. I crawled all over that car. I couldn't open the tailgate. We Google every single thing we can find online about how to release the tailgate and get all sorts of random instructions about how there's a thing under the bumper. Nope, I learned how to take the cover off. I want to hook up a trailer. Not the right thing. Put that back on. Learned how to do all sorts of other stuff. Cannot find any way to make that tailgate pop from the exterior. There's no spot to put in like a manual key, you know, your little key that you have in your fob. Mm-hmm. Nope. That wherever it was. Now, mind you, 9 o'clock in the dark, we're doing this on the ground at a parking garage. So if it was right in front of me, we could not find it. And I'm like, well, they say it's in the driver's side rear quarter panel is where it is. That's what Jeep had told me the first time this happened. So still can't get it open. So what have I done? We have pulled the luggage over the front seats, like out there, because we're going to put them in. So we had put it all back. Nope, we'll take everything out. Fold the seats down, take everything I had in the back out, take the cargo cover for the floor, the hard cargo cover. Now, I am laying down across the seats in the dark with Russ's phone as a flashlight, trying to release the cargo cover from the wrong angle, right? Because you have to pull it towards the back of the tailgate. And then, well, that's pushing now, right? Get it released. Can't entirely get it up to the front. So it's sideways, pulled up half on top of me. And I'm like, angled into the cargo area going, there's nothing here. There's no panel. There's no screw. There's no bolt. There's no latch. There is nothing I can find. And again, if it's right there, sideways, half under the cargo cover at now probably 9:30 at night in the dark with only a cell phone as a light, I could not find it. We give up. We give up. We've tried everything. We even like found an access thing inside the frunk. I'm like, that is not what we're looking for, right? So put all that back together. So we can't. So we tried everything to see if there was a way to access the 12 volts, jump it. Nobody can find it. I can't figure it out. So the guy finally comes. We even get to sit after all this. We had about half an hour to just sit there on our butts in my dead car in the parking garage. And he comes and he hooks it up to the dollies to tow it out. When you tow it out, you have to go through the gates where you would normally pay. And this is where the story literally goes sideways. As the driver...
Oh, it hasn't gone sideways yet.
No. It's actually going somewhat straight so far. The front part of the towing mechanism, which is like this T-bar kind of looking thing for that lifts your front wheels off of the ground, and there's little dollies on the back wheels, the front of it catches the post as we go through the gate. When it catches the post, it pops off the front tires, pokes up in the air, lifts the front tires up on one side, snaps the dolly off the back tires, which the dolly goes, wee, and smacks sideways into the back. And now my car is stuck in the gates on two wheels underneath the jack and I'm underneath the tow thing. And I'm like, and I have literally just said to Russ, who's waiting with the other driver, we'll be right there. I'm like, no, we won't. Text. It's going to be a minute. Text. And I send him a picture of the car.
So when you said sideways, you meant literally sideways.
Literally sideways. It's like got its front wheel is up and at an angle. It's like lifted off the ground and it's, yeah. And now I'm like, I get out and I'm like, how bad is this? Because I'm riding in the tow truck. I get out of the tow truck and I look at this and I'm like, huh, did it just get tipped funny sideways? Oh no, it didn't just get tipped funny sideways. The plastic trim is ripped off the front of the bottom, like the underneath. On the side where the like T-bar thing has gone into the car, my beautiful black shiny wheel is now one with the cement curb. It's like right up the curb when it did that. I can see that it's weirdly angled, but again, I'm in a parking garage in the dark, so I can only see so much. I can see scraping from the dolly on the back of the car, again, on the lower area of the car. So it's all scraped to heck. So I'm like, there's damage. The first thing I say, I'm like, okay, you guys, wait. How are we taking care of this? Because now you ruined the car. Like before it was a Jeep problem. Now it's a Jeep and a Massport problem. So I had to fill out all this claim form. I took a bunch of pictures while I was there. I took it to the Jeep guys. When I spoke to them on Saturday morning and told them what happened, he's like, yeah, the car is still in the parking lot. We're looking at it. He's like, but I had a guy shimmy under your car, like in the lot to look at it. He's like, that jack actually, the tow truck poked a hole into part of the cover underneath. There's really like a hole. And I said, so is this cosmetic stuff or did it do something? He's like, we won't know until we get it up on a actual lift. And he said, and you have a lot of damage underneath that car. He said, I said, would you take pictures? He's like, we're not just going to take pictures. We're going to take pictures of everything. And we're going to write up an entire list, like what we see that's damaged that needs to be repaired. They gave me a loaner. I have a lovely little Jeep Compass in the driveway where they try and figure out the battery issue, which is their responsibility. And I have a claim form filed with Massport, which is now Massport's responsibility, and I have to call them. And I'm driving this Compass around for the next week.
Massport will cut you a check on Monday morning and, you know, it'll all be good.
For the love. That's the stressful part. Honestly, that's the worst part. I'm like, oh gosh, I have to deal with like an official government agency in Massachusetts. Now the garage guy, his name was Jesus. He's the manager. He was fantabulous. Actually said, you'd be surprised how often random things happen in the garage. Like, especially in the winter, they're, plowing on the roof and they clip a car, whatever. He said, they have policies to handle this. He's like, your car is brand new. It's not like they're going to look and go, well, that was existing damage. Like, and I even happen to have a picture of the guy hooking it up to the dollies in the parking space where you can see it was in one piece. But yeah, so I have to deal with that now. Loving this car right now. Let me tell you, this has been the single best new purchase car experience of my life, Sam.
When you did get into the car, mm-hmm. and you were before you were crawling around under the mm-hmm. cargo cover, mm-hmm. you know, did anything come on at all?
Completely dead. And the thing was, I clicked the door to unlock the door, and it did unlock. So it was had 1/100th of an ounce of juice in it. I don't know. I clicked the door to unlock, but then I opened it, and everything's black. And I was like, uh oh. And then I shut the door because that's habit and hit start and it won't start. And for a second, the door wouldn't. I had to use a little emergency release, which is sort of like under the armrest to pop the door because the door didn't want to power open. So then we just opened the doors and yeah. And it did still open. Russ opened the door on the other side and it opened. So I don't know what. It was like, I'll give you door power, but that's it. I don't know quite how that worked.
It may be that there's a capacitor in there somewhere that's got enough energy just to unlatch the doors.
Maybe. But it is not enough to unlatch the tailgate. It won't let you open the tailgate. And I even looked like I turned the light off because I know trunks obviously have the emergency little thing that glows in the dark if you were actually shut in a trunk. I'm thinking, I don't think this will have one because it's a hatchback. It's not a trunk. But I did sit there in the dark for a second. I'm like, nope, nothing's glowing. Can't get this open. So
I wonder, because you said you plugged it in when you got to the parking garage?
And it charged. It said it was charging, and it charged. And because we were at the garage for 5 hours waiting for our flight, I even got the notification saying, your Jeep is charging. And then I got a notification saying, your Jeep is done charging.
I wonder if there was some kind of issue, an interaction between the charger and the vehicle that may have damaged the vehicle. Because that has happened in the past.
It could, but I mean, it could. That could potentially be what happened. I somehow don't think that because, I mean, I've charged at that charging station countless times. You know, I've used, I mean, not that exact one, although I could have. You know what I mean? Like, I've used those chargers. There could have been, but it seemed like it finished charging like normal. Like I didn't, every now and then something's gone wrong. Like we've had power fluctuate at the house when it was plugged in or something. And I'll get like charging stopped, charging started, charging interrupted. I didn't get any kind of like notification saying something went sideways with the actual charging. Could have, but yeah. So now my car is at, and I want to be really clear because it's like, this is not a great thing. And as a customer, I am not happy, but I have to give credit to my dealership who's taking it really seriously. Like the Alan Mello guys are like, okay, no, we can't just replace.
They know that you know people.
They do. Yeah. But also he said, he's like, the 12 volt went the first time. We saw no other things. So we replaced the 12 volt. It can't have got, there's no way. Like something is wrong. We got to figure it out. They said they called to figure it out. So, or they reached out to Chrysler, you know, to see what's going on. And so that everyone knows I'm being really fair as a journalist, I reached out to Jeep and said, hey, I'm having this problem. It's in the dealership. This is where it is. I am going to be talking about this, but feel free to read, like, if you want to add, like, hey, this is what, if there's something to the story that you know, if there's something Jeep wise, like we're aware of this or we have this, or feel free, and I will share that. Now, this was all on a Friday night / Saturday morning. We're recording on a Sunday, so we don't have anything from Jeep to share about their feedback about this. But I did reach out to them to try and get some kind of information from them. And if there is information, I'll, of course, share it. The dealership has been, and they do know who I am. They do know that I know, you know.
You know people.
I know people. Like, not as like, I know people, but like, well, she can reach out. If we don't reach out, she will, you know. But they have been really good. You know, they got me a loaner. He told me, and he was, you know, we're trying to get this done. We're going to go as quick as possible. We're a little bit, you know, we're a little bit stuck because we need some help here. We don't know why this is happening. And if it's not giving us a code, we don't know where to look, you know? So, and he made an interesting comment, and this wasn't like as a sarcasm or as anything, but I'm like, it really, it truly is something I think that any mechanic is facing. He said, you know, we have really great mechanics here. These guys know these cars. They're really good at fixing cars. Like, but they're getting so going electric. He's like, they have to be electricians now, and they're not electricians. They're mechanics. He said, it's a whole different thing for them to do, and it poses challenges.
And in many cases, it's not even just electricians. It's you need to know the software,
right?
Because a lot of times there's the software component.
Exactly. And he said they can plug in the diagnostics and say what is it, and it can throw a code, and they can look up the code and then say, oh, this thing went wrong or that thing went wrong. But the days you can't just open up and physically look at software and go, that code isn't working. Something has to tell you what's not working for you to know what is causing the problem. The one thing he did mention was that there was a they have no bulletin about this, technical service bulletin, TSB, about this, but they did say they had one about something with the motors that could potentially cause an electrical problem, but he hadn't plugged it all in and checked it yet. He's like, it could be that. He's like, but so we'll see what the good folks at Alamelo Dodge say, and we'll see what the folks at Jeep say, and I will keep everyone updated. And, this is really hard for me, because I love this car otherwise, and I like the car. And I knew that, you know, Jeep does not have the best reliability. I did not expect it to be quite this bad. I was not anticipating this, and I'm trying to be really fair, but like the consumer side of me, if I was just a consumer talking to you, Sam, I'd be losing my mind, which is kind of where I was on Friday. I have calmed down since.
The text you sent me on Friday night.
I was like, guess what just happened?
I know how you feel. Like, you know, when we bought our first Volkswagen back in 2000, it was a 2000 Passat wagon.
Yeah.
We loved driving that car. But you know, that car over the 9 years we owned it had more mechanical issues and engine issues really,
right,
than any other vehicle I've ever owned.
Yeah.
Spent a lot of time in the shop over the years.
This has been probably the worst track record, the quickest of any car that we have. So it was, I brought it in, because there was just a recall, and where I don't need to quote service it, I'm like, I got to make an appointment, you know, because it's not like I have to change the oil in this. I'm like, I should. And it was related to lighting. It didn't actually cause a mechanical issue, but I had a piece that had broken off when I flipped the visor down. A piece of plastic just snapped and fell into my lap. So I'm like, can we take care of that? So they've ordered that piece. So I had the little visor piece snap. I had the frunk that was doing a funky thing and had to be adjusted because it wouldn't close. I had the 12 volt go once, and I believe the 12 volt go again. So I got this in March. It's the middle of July, April, May, June, July. So not quite 5 months. That's a lot of problems. Two of which were catastrophic failures, basically, you know, even the frunk, if that had happened and I was out in the middle of nowhere and I couldn't close the frunk, how do you drive a car where your hood can just like flip, you know?
Yeah.
So potentially
bungee cord.
Exactly. Oh, Russ would have been bungeeing that thing. That would have been a sight. So it's not a great experience. We did do some Googling, and I'll say this caveat with, you know, Googling brings you whatever consumers say. Russ actually was reading because he was trying to figure out a way to get it going. And there's a lot of people reporting problems with their 12 volt on their Wagoneer S. And some of them were saying there's a way you can, and we just can't figure out how to access that stupid battery. But they said if you disconnect the port and reconnect the port But you need to have this size wrench to be able to access and do it, and that you should keep the wrench in your glove box. I'm like, I'm not driving around with the wrench in my glove box because my battery, like, that's just not a great. Now, I don't know that that's 1,000 people or the 5 people on this forum, you know what I mean? But the fact that when you Google this, you actually do find some issues with this. So I'm hoping that I get some kind of answer from Jeep, not in a way like I need answers, but like, I'm really curious. What's happening? It feels like something is not quite right. And if it's dumb luck, that's pretty unusual dumb luck, you know?
Well, to be fair, Jeep is not the only one that's having issues with 12-volt batteries on EVs.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. In the past with combustion vehicles and even with some EVs before we started getting into, the so-called software-defined vehicles, the 12-volt battery was just something that it just got charged, it got charged off your alternator.
Right.
It was a mechanical thing. There was no software governing it, when it should charge or not charge. And with these modern vehicles, now you've got a software component in there and you've got a bunch of electronics deciding when you need to charge this thing. That's been a problem for a lot of manufacturers.
Yeah, it's
including
not.
Tesla.
And didn't Kia and Hyundai have a big problem? Wait, the Kia,
part of the reason we got such a good price on ours was because Kia bought it back from a customer who was unsatisfied. He was frustrated with waiting for the recall. Kia and Hyundai had done a recall on their EVs to replace the charge control unit, which includes the DC-DC converter that goes from the high voltage battery to the 12 volt. And, we've answered a couple of questions in the past from listeners with Ioniq 5s and other Hyundais. And I reached out to Hyundai about it and they acknowledged, there's an issue with that charge control unit. They've got a recall on that. They're replacing those. The car we bought has had that replaced.
Mm-hmm.
We haven't had any issues yet. As far as I know, newer ones are not having issues right now, but Ford still has an ongoing recall on Mach-Es. And I think most automakers at some point in the past few years have had an issue with one or more of their EVs with 12-volt batteries dying.
Well, and it's an interesting, and that's, and a point that I wanted to make, and I'm glad you brought it up. This isn't a Jeep thing. This isn't like Jeep is the only OEM that's having trouble with this. Like you said, they're all kind of having trouble with this. I think the thing for me, part of when I bought this car for a lot of reasons. I like Jeeps, which I think everyone knows. I needed a new car. I wanted something that was, I've had the same car. My old car was a 2010 Dodge Charger. It was just done. It was fine, but it's just old in every conceivable way. And I wanted something new with new tech, and I wanted it to be a little bit fancy. So it checked a lot of boxes for me. And the part of the EV thing was we get EVs to drive every week on occasion. An EV could end up in your driveway. It's one thing to get a car and drive it for a week as a loner. It's another thing to live with it. And there was a part of me that was really curious. Okay, let's see how it is to live with having an EV. It's not proving to be great at the moment. In fact, even for this, like the timing on this was actually weirdly not as bad as it could have been, because I was going to a family thing in DC, flying home. I was going to drive directly to a Slate event in Newport, drive directly to the airport to drive a Hyundai, drive direct, then come home. And then we were going to North Carolina and driving home. At any point in there where I was going to rely on this for a trip for the first time, like really like going places, it could have failed, and it could have failed in the parking lot in Newport. Now I'm not getting to the Hyundai event on time because I can't get to the airport. It at any point in there, if it had failed, it actually would have been more inconvenient. At least this just had me dealing with getting it out of Boston and going to bed at 2:30 in the morning, because that's how long it took to get all of this squared away. But it really hit home. And again, this isn't Jeep. This is just EVs. When this problem happens, there's so much more. You can't just open the hood and jump the battery and at least get yourself home. You can't. It's more complicated. You can't just tow it like normal because you can't do that with an EV. You have to flatbed it. And it is a complicated process. And, you know, it was interesting, you know, Russ being an engineer looks at everything from an engineering point of view. And his engineering point of view was just like, why do we design this way? This should be easier. And he's not wrong. It should be easier. It shouldn't, you know, it shouldn't take the two of us trying to find this and Googling and trying to find whatever we can and not getting an answer to figure out how to do this kind of stuff. And so, like, I'm not anti-EV by any means, but man, this has been a challenge and this has been a major inconvenience. This particular time, it's going to be an even bigger headache because a tow company managed to damage the car, which, you know, could happen with any vehicle, but it's like, okay, now my inconvenience has multiplied 100-fold having to deal with that. So, and I wanted to know what it was like to live with an EV. And I'm thinking at this exact moment in time at 11:59 on July 27th, not great, folks, not great. I'm not loving my decision right now. Maybe I'll be loving my decision next time record. Right now, not loving my decision.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
So far, we're doing fine with our EV6.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Robbie has had a good experience now with two EVs, with a Kona and an Ioniq 5. We'll have to keep you up to date.
I'll let you know. Hopefully, the next podcast, I should have something additional to say. Hopefully, that's a week away. So let's see.
And when we get around to listener emails at the end, we will circle back on the 12-volt issue.
Yes. Okay.
All right.
If you're a maintenance supervisor at a manufacturing facility and your machinery isn't working right, Grainger knows you need to understand what's wrong as soon as possible. So when a conveyor motor falters, Grainger offers diagnostic tools like calibration kits and multimeters to help you identify and fix the problem. With Grainger, you can be confident you have everything you need to keep your facility running smoothly. Call 1-800-GRAINGER, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Did you know you can support Wheel Bearings directly? Head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia and you can become a patron today. Your contributions will help fund the platforms and tools we use to bring the podcast to you. And exclusives and improvements are already on the way thanks to your generosity. So if you want to be part of an automotive podcast like no other, head to patreon.com/wheelbearingsmedia. We've updated the Wheel Bearings merch store, and now there's a whole bunch of new choices, new colors, new styles, T-shirts, sweatshirts, hoodies, hats, mugs, travel mugs, stickers, aprons, tote bags, you name it. You can get your Wheel Bearings merch at shop.wheelbearings.media. Go check it out. That's shop.wheelbearings.media. So did you drive anything this week that didn't leave you stranded?
I did drive something this week that did not leave me stranded. I drove the 2025 Crown Signia, which the Toyota Crown Signia. The Crown is already out, but the Signia, which is sort of like an SUV kind of.
The wagon.
It's a wagon. I mean, it's a wagon. Let's be honest. It's a wagon. Yeah. That just came out this year. It's supposed to replace the Venza, as I understand it. Mm-hmm. So the Venza's dead. So this is a hybrid only. It has standard all-wheel drive. It's got the, you know, normal Toyota safety stuff that's on there, a nice 12.3-inch touchscreen. There's just two trims. So you don't have a lot of options here. There's the XLE or the Limited. I had the Limited, which is $47,990. I did not have a Maroni, so I did not build this one out. But you want to take a guess at the destination fee? I mean, you win no matter
$13.95.
Holy cow. Exactly. Did you? You cheated, didn't you?
I did not.
Okay. You're.
It was a guess.
You're exactly right.
I had a Crown Signia a couple months ago.
Okay.
And I couldn't remember exactly what the number was, but I recall it being somewhere in that neighborhood.
Well, apparently you did remember exactly. $13.95. Okay. So the top trim I'm driving, $47,990. It's actually has a really nice interior. It's nice. It's comfortable. It looks good. Everything is, you know, no complaints. It's a typical Toyota interior. Toyota has nice interiors. They're not generally super fancy, but they're not horrible and cheap either. They tend to look a little bit better as a rule. And I really liked how the interior was. Very comfortable. Drove this around quite a bit. Very comfortable ride. There's room, you know, it's five people. So the second row, it's roomy, but it's not super roomy. I feel like if you were, you know, if it was Robbie and Russ, one sit in front of the other, we're going to have problems. But if it's, you know, average height person and tall person, you're probably going to be good. And it is comfy. I think you could fit three back there. Three is going to be squishy. So three is going to be a short drive. Two, okay. Two people can sit back there and you won't be too bad. Power comes from a 2.5 liter four cylinder. It's a hybrid. There's two electric motors because it has the standard all-wheel drive. You get 100 and what? I'm looking at my own notes and I don't understand them. Total, what is it giving me? The torque, it broke out very weirdly here. 240 horsepower is what it has combined. And I believe the combined torque, it's got, it says 178 from the gas engine that it broke it all out. Shoot, the way when I looked it up, I think it's about 280 pound feet of torque is what it'll roughly be combined. So it's roomy enough and it's comfortable enough and it's powerful enough. It actually is pretty responsive. If you mash the gas pedal on the highway, it goes, and it handles nicely.
And it lets you know what's going.
It does. It's a little on the loud side, that CVT. It's like, oh, hello, we're going. So it's not quiet about it. In fact, I had gone to the movies with a friend and we were getting into heavy traffic and I had to accelerate hard to get up to speed in really congested traffic because there wasn't a lot of room. And she was like, whoa, like not the power of it, but the noise of it. So you know that you're accelerating. You know, how much of a drawback is that? You're buying a hybrid wagon. You're probably going to not have the most robust powertrain in the planet. And given it has a CVT, you're probably going to know it. I was fine with the horsepower. If you're looking for super refined and quiet and elegant and luxury, that's not this car, which is fine. It's also that car is going to be more expensive than this car. There's good room behind the second row. There's 25.8 cubic feet back there. Fold them down, 68.8. So you can fit a good amount of stuff back there. It's pretty roomy. And you can tow 2,700 pounds. So not a huge towing capacity, but you could tow something on the smaller side, which is fine. There's, like I said, there's a 12.3-inch standard infotainment touchscreen that works well. It's a nice, good size screen. I think that's a good screen size, like that 12 to 13 inch screen size mm-hmm. in a car. You get bigger and they get kind of, they're almost like intrusive to the interior of the vehicle. You're like, okay, I don't need that much. You get much smaller and it's less easy to follow things like directions and maps, especially if it's someplace you're on, you know, city streets where things can get a little complicated quickly. So I like this screen size. I think this is good. I have an 11-speaker JBL premium audio system. Sounds great. No problems with it. Base trim gets a 6-speaker audio. You get wireless, you know, connectivity. You know, you get things like in the Limited, there's leather trim seats. They're heated and ventilated. You get a heated steering wheel. There's this glass roof. It's a fixed glass roof, but it's the entire length of the vehicle. Like it goes to the back seat. So it really lets in a lot of light, really makes it feel very open. I love that. I prefer to have something where I've got like a roof that, you know, a sunroof or whatever, but at least having the ability to put that light in a car, it always makes it feel so much more open and airy. And even if you are squished in there, you don't feel quite so squished in like in the back seat. If you just have some light over your head and don't feel like you're a little cave. So I did like that. Overall, I like this. I think the Crown Signia is a good car. They bill it as being like there's a Toyota Crown and then there's a Toyota Crown Signia and this is the expansion of the Crown lineup. Okay. I feel like I don't know how much you can expand it, but I think overall I am a fan of the Crown Signia. I did like it. It's like a lot of Toyotas. It's not something that you're buying. I feel like Toyota's for a person that wants a reliable car that's sturdy and attractive and is going to go for as long as they want to own it and is reasonably responsive and powerful. And that's what this is. It's not sporty. It's not super, it's not luxury. It doesn't have like an incredible amount of power. It checks all the boxes nicely at a reasonable price and with good reliability. So I'm a fan overall. I liked it.
Cool. Yeah. I like the look of the Signia mm-hmm. much better than the sedan.
Yes, I agree. Yeah.
I think it's a good shape. You know, it's a decent size. You know, I think it's a good family vehicle, you know, for, you know, if you got a couple of kids,
mm-hmm.
You know, if you need a third row, it's obviously not the right choice for you. But, if you don't need a third row, I think it's a really good combination. The thing that would be nice, and I was kind of surprised at, is that they don't offer the Hybrid Max powertrain in here.
Yeah, I wonder if it was, do you think it was a pricing thing? Like, it's only two trims, so they went really, you know, only two, 43.5 for the base, 47.9 for the limited. Do you think they were just trying to make it really simple and easy and not complicated and just chose not to do the more expensive Max?
I don't know, because, you know, the Crown Sedan is available with the Hybrid Max.
Mm-hmm.
So you can get it with either the standard regular Toyota hybrid system, as they call it, or the Hybrid Max.
Yeah.
Let me see. What was the price on that one?
Because I know the Max does add a little to it. So.
Yeah. And, you know, the thing about the Hybrid Max is it's not a CVT setup. So it uses a conventional 6-speed transmission.
I'm a fan of the Toyota's Hybrid Max. Like, if I was driving a vehicle where they had the hybrid, standard hybrid like this, or if they had the Hybrid Max, I go the Hybrid Max every time because it's more responsive, it's quieter, it's just a better powertrain. I far prefer it. Like, if this had that as an option, I would do that.
Let's see.
I wonder why. That's a question for...
Yeah, I don't know. Let's see. So the Crown Sedan, like the Crown Limited with the regular hybrid system is 47,570.
Okay.
And then the Platinum, which has the Hybrid Max in there, is $54,990. So it's about $9,000 difference.
So it's a chunk of money.
Yeah. So it is quite a bit more expensive. But, again, it's only in the Platinum trim, which also gets you a lot of other equipment. So I'm guessing the powertrain cost, you know, is probably going to be somewhere around $3,000 or $4,000 if they just offered that option as a standalone option, which they don't.
Instead of, yeah. But if it would up that, it would make, I guess it would make that base trim, though, you'll get over 50 then in these for 346. Yeah, it would definitely push that limited trim over 50 maybe. Yeah. And it would be weird to just offer it on the base trim. Maybe they were trying to keep this under 50.
That could be.
You know?
Yeah. And perhaps, you know, they were thinking, you know, they looked at it and they're thinking that, you know, this, even though, you know, we're calling this a crossover, you know, that consumers are going to look at it and think, oh, yeah, that's a really nice wagon. I'm not going to buy it. and so maybe they figured they're just not going to sell that many of them.
That could be.
Who knows?
Yeah, interesting choice. I really do like the Hybrid Max better. That powertrain.
I do too.
One. Yeah.
All right. Well, I also had a Toyota.
Oh.
With the regular Toyota hybrid system in there.
This is why I accused you of cheating. I'm like, wait, he has it on his for his car.
But the destination charge on mine is different. Because the one I drove is built in Kentucky.
Oh.
The Crown Signia is built in Japan.
Okay, I'm gonna go $995?
No.
Oh, I was trying. What is it?
$1,450.
It went the other way.
Yeah. But it is a bigger vehicle.
That's true. So I guess net-net, it's probably less per pound or something.
Yeah, if you did it on a per pound basis, it's probably less.
Like when you look at the tag in the grocery store, per ounce.
Yeah, so Toyota launched the Grand Highlander a couple of years ago. We went to Hawaii to drive that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, the Highlander for several generations now has offered, it's been a three row vehicle, but the third row was always kind of cramped. And so they introduced the Grand Highlander, which is based on the same architecture, but it's a little bit longer, a little bit longer wheelbase. And it has a proper third row that adults can sit in. You probably don't want to sit in there for a cross-country road trip,
mm-hmm.
But you know, certainly for shorter trips, you know, or across, you know, even, you know, a couple of hours, I wouldn't mind. I would be okay with sitting in the back, in the third row of this thing.
Mm-hmm.
You can sit up, sit upright. You're not knees in the air in this thing. You know, you're not pushed up against the back of the second row seats. So it's a useful third row vehicle or three row vehicle. There's three powertrain options in the Grand Highlander. You can get the regular 2.5 liter turbo with no hybrid, which is about 265 horsepower. There is the regular hybrid, which is basically the same setup that was in the Crown Signia that you drove, which has the eCVT. That one's 245 horsepower in the Grand Highlander. And then the Hybrid Max, which combines the 2.5 liter turbo with, or actually, sorry, it's a 2.4 liter turbo with a six speed automatic for 400 horsepower, or 400 foot pounds of torque, 362 horsepower. That one is the most fun to drive, but that's not what I had. I had the hybrid, which, you know, the 245 horsepower is adequate. You know, it's you're not going to mistake this for driving a Supra or a BRZ or a GR Corolla.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, it'll get you around. It'll accelerate up to highway speeds without too much difficulty. And as long as you don't try to accelerate too fast, you're not going to get that droning of the engine at 4,000 RPM for several seconds. The biggest flaw of Toyota's hybrid systems is that their four-cylinder engines just don't sound very good.
Mm-hmm.
And if they were better sounding engines, it'd be so much more pleasant to drive. But they're not. And so, but on the other hand, they're reliable and you, get really good fuel economy out of them. You know, so this is a big vehicle. And it is EPA rated at, let me get back to the Monroney here, 34 miles per gallon combined, 36 city, 32 highway. I averaged about 32 overall during my week with the Grand Highlander. You know, it's easy to drive around. It's got a lot of the same features that are in the Crown Signia, 11 speaker JBL sound system. It's got, this one doesn't have, any kind of hands-free driving system, but it's got the regular Toyota Safety Sense 3.0. So you got adaptive cruise control and lane keeping or lane centering, even blind spot monitoring, cross traffic alert, you know, all that stuff. No heads up display in this one in the limited that I, or sorry, the version, the one that I had was the Nightshade, the hybrid Nightshade.
What's Nightshade?
Nightshade is this trim level that Toyota's been rolling out on almost all of their models over the last couple of years.
My brain wanted to make it a color. I'm like, no, wait, it's a trim.
Yeah. Well, it's a trim with just a couple of color options. So the way you tell a Nightshade, the easiest way to tell a Nightshade, it's got black wheels, black trim all around. So like the lower front bumper, the rocker panels, the pillars, that's all in black. And then like a dark gray or black for the grill, hence Nightshade. And you can get it in three exciting colors. Windchill Pearl, which is white. Midnight Black Metallic,
mm-hmm.
black. Or Cement.
Cement?
I'm sure you can guess what that looks like.
Purple.
No.
Gray.
It is gray. It is one of the most boring color palettes of all time. But if what you're interested in doing is being completely stealthy and utterly invisible to police with sitting at the side of the highway with radar guns, this is your choice.
There you go.
This is the one to have, because you could probably drive by a cop sitting there with a radar gun at 120 miles an hour. And he probably won't even see you.
You just blend right in.
Exactly. You'll be exactly the same shade as the pavement and everything else around you. You know, he'll be picking off, you know, some poor schmuck driving 5 miles an hour below the speed limit in a bright red Corolla.
There you go. The Corolla, yeah. The bright red. Bright red. Yeah. They always say red cars get picked off exactly. More often, but.
Yeah. But, you know, I mean, you know, this is meant to be a large family hauler. And also behind the third row, unlike the regular Highlander, which has, I think, about 6 inches of cargo space behind the third row when the third row seats are up. You know, this, you can actually fit stuff, you know, bags and, you can put a bunch of roller bags in there, or, you know, if you've got young kids and you need to carry a playpen or, assorted other, child detritus, it'll all fit in there with no problem at all.
Nice and roomy. Good family choice.
Yeah. All in, the Nightshade version that I have, the base price of the Nightshade is $52,610. The one I drove came to $59,207, thanks to the, $600 for the panoramic view monitor, so the surround sound cameras. $1,350 for the panoramic roof.
Wow, that's kind of a lot. Well, $1,350, yeah, it's a big roof. It's
yeah,
a big
it is.
Vehicle, so.
Yeah, you get 3 rows to expose. The illuminated cargo sills are $345. Illuminated door sills, another $345. Mudguard. You know, there's a bunch of stuff on this one that you probably, like, for example, the running boards. Running boards are $799.
Get rid of this.
This is, you know, technically an SUV, but this is not like trying to climb into a Raptor or, you know, a TRD Pro. You know, these running boards feel like they're so low to the ground. You know, you don't actually need them.
They just are there to look cool.
You know, unless you're planning to use this in parades and have people, standing on the running boards, hanging on to the pillars with the windows open and waving as you go down your main street of your town on July 4th. Don't save the $800.
Yeah, I don't think I would get them.
Yeah. What else? Yeah, that's about it. I mean, the Grand Highlander Nightshade Hybrid, it's a good family hauler. I still prefer a minivan for this kind of application. And you can get the Sienna minivan standard with this exact same powertrain.
Mm-hmm.
And it has sliding doors that
it's a really
when
good
your
minivan.
Kids are trying to get out.
Yeah, I like the Sienna.
They're not
going
to bang the cars next to you.
In theory, they won't bang the cars with the doors, but they'll still find a way to bang the cars. They'll walk into the side view mirror. Their backpack's going to smack it. Random iPad, blop. Yeah, something. Because they're kids.
I've raised a couple of them,
They've kind of flail.
They're gone. They're on their own now. They're mostly self-sustaining.
Mostly.
Yeah. So that's the 2025 Grand Highlander Nightshade Hybrid.
Nice.
Let's see. Let's move on. Okay. So back to EVs and charging.
Yes.
Two more manufacturers this week that announced that they have added support for charging at Tesla superchargers. You got Honda for the Prelude or the Prologue, I should say. And the Acura ZDX, that's a pretty straightforward one because those are built by GM. They're using the same, they're offering the same Electron manufactured adapters that GM is offering for like $225. Right now, they don't yet have plug-in charge on those vehicles, and the Honda app, the Honda and Acura apps, still don't have support for managing charging at superchargers. So you have to utilize the Tesla app, but they charge at full speed, you know, the 150 or so kilowatts that those vehicles support. And then there's the Lucid Air.
I love the Lucids. I really do love those vehicles.
I do. But I mean, and I'm going to be in California next week for a little while. I'll be going to the same Hyundai program that you're going to, but on a different day. And then spending a long weekend with my wife in Sonoma.
Nice.
And we're going to be driving a Lucid Air. But I don't think I'm going to bother trying it out at a supercharger station.
No, why not?
You know, the Lucid Air, one of the great things about it, it's a 900-volt architecture, and if you plug it into a an Electrify America or, you know, other 350-kilowatt CCS charger, it'll crank along at, you know, 260, 70, 80 kilowatts to charge. It charges really fast. If you plug it into a supercharger, not so much.
This is so slow.
You get 50 kilowatts.
This is so slow.
Yes.
So it's not. So
and that's because of it's the Air, the power electronics box. They call it the Wunderbox. That handles, you know, it's the inverter and the charging unit and all this stuff. The way it was set up, it was not designed to support the supercharger, which, you know, runs at only 400 volts. And so what they actually had to do to get supercharger support is they, when you plug into a supercharger, instead of just going, letting the electrons flow directly from the charger into the battery, because it's direct current all the way, what they end up actually doing is it goes through the Wunderbox, where it's actually converting it from DC of the charger to AC, to alternating current, like you would get a level 2 charger, and then pumping that into the battery.
So you will get a whopping 200 miles per hour of charging.
Yeah.
That's, I feel like, a sad trombone. We need that sound effect right there. Wah, wah.
I know. So this will charge about as fast as a Chevy Bolt on a supercharger.
Not ideal. I mean, not bad. It still gives you access to it, right? You still use it if that's the charger that you have available.
As a last resort.
Right? So it gives you more access points, technically, but just a really slow one. Really slow one. What a bummer. Should have bought a Lucid Gravity.
And also the charge port is on the wrong side for a supercharger, which means that you'll be taking up an extra parking space from a Tesla owner and pissing them off because you're there for so long.
Right. You're taking that spot up. Everybody else has been in and out and in and out. And you're just like, just hanging out, reading a book, drinking a latte.
Yeah. So if you got a Lucid Air, look for Electrify America, EVgo, ChargePoint, or Iona, 350 or 400 kilowatt chargers as your preferred approach.
Yeah.
The Gravity, the Lucid Gravity, is set up differently. It doesn't use the same Wunderbox system, so it'll actually charge at 225 kilowatts on a supercharger.
So that's good. That's a little better.
So if you have a Gravity, if you're one of the, you know, 20 or 30 people that have gotten a Gravity so far, I like the Gravity, it has not been a really fast seller so far.
It hasn't, but I think EVs just in general, there's a lot of, you know, politics and cost, and now it's not the cool thing anymore. It was cool and new, and now it's just like, people go back and forth. I go back and forth.
So let's go back to Honda.
Okay, back to Honda.
What did you think of the Acura TLX?
Fine. Acura TLX was just fine. Cool little car. Yeah, nice little sedan. Did its thing. Yeah, I was okay with the TLX. Why is that?
Because it is no more. With the end of the 2025 model year, it has ended production.
Another sedan bites the dust.
Yep.
We're going to have no sedans.
It's a good-looking sedan, too.
It does. Actually, it is a really good-looking vehicle. We're going to have no sedans. We're just going to have little compact cars, a few of them out there, for people who want to and little compact crossovers. What do we have then for sedans? I'm looking at Honda. We have...
So you got Toyota
Civic,
Camry.
Civic.
And Corolla.
No, but I mean for Honda. All we're going to have...
Honda. They have the Accord.
For Acura. Sorry, I'm looking at the wrong company.
Acura's got nothing.
Nothing.
It's all crossovers
it, right?
Now.
The last one.
But yeah, Honda's got the Civic and the Accord.
And I was thinking,
and then they'll have the Zero Series Saloon next year.
Right. Hopefully.
But no Acura sedans.
No Acura sedans. That's.
There's the Integra.
And so we have Integra, TLX, no more, ZDX. Yeah, ZDX, ADX, RDX, MDX. The TLX is gone, so just be the Integra. Yeah. Do you think they'll kill Integra? Is Integra doing well?
No, I haven't looked at the sales lately.
I'm scared for Integra. They just brought it back, for crying out loud.
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, it is based on the Civic, which still sells really well.
True.
So it could be kept around. It's definitely doing better than the TLX.
Yeah, apparently.
Yeah, for now. All right. And then the other news from Honda is they released some information about the Prelude that's coming up this fall, the new Prelude. And the Prelude is a new coupe based on the Civic platform. And it's going to be hybrid only.
Mm-hmm.
So it will have the powertrain from the Civic Hybrid, so about 200, 201 horsepower. But the suspension is coming straight from the Civic Type R.
That should make it really fun.
Yeah. Because
it should make it a lot of fun.
Yeah. The Type R has completely different front suspension from other Civics. So it's got... what they call it's a dual axis setup. So the steering axis is separate from trying to remember now.
You've lost your technical edge. So yeah. All of a sudden it went out. Lost.
But basically what it does is it effectively eliminates torque steer.
Mm-hmm.
So you can drive this thing really quickly, accelerate out of curves, and not have the wheel get twisted out of your hands. And it's using the same brakes, the same Brembo brakes from the Type R as well. So it could actually be really fun to drive.
And it also says in here that the hybrid system is getting paired for the first time with the Honda S Plus shift system. I want to make sure I got that right, which... is supposed to basically enhance, you know, control and handling and make it all better and fancy. So it should be fun. I'm looking forward to this. I'm still a little bit sad because they didn't give me little pop-up headlights. I know those aren't a thing anymore, but I feel like the Prelude should have pop-up headlights or it's wrong. It would be like getting rid of the drop top in a Miata. It breaks my heart.
Well, the last couple generations of the old Prelude had fixed headlights as well.
Which was a mistake.
That's why they got canceled, right?
See, they got rid of the headlights. They're like, well, no one wants it without the pop-up headlights. Let's kill the car.
Good point. It's funny, when we went to sell our Civic back to the dealer where we bought it from, when we bought the EV6, they actually had a first-generation Civic, or first-generation Prelude,
I should say,
sitting in the deal in the showroom.
No way.
A gold one, yeah.
Gold. Oh, my God. That's perfect.
Very 1970s.
I was going to say, that is the color you want for a first-gen. So that, like, hello, I'm driving 1970 down the road.
Yeah.
That's awesome.
All right. So looking forward to getting to try out the new Prelude this fall.
Yeah.
The Civic Hybrid was surprisingly fun to drive.
I like the Civic Hybrid. I thought it was a good little car. So yeah, or is. I say was like it's, it is a good little car.
I mean, I gave it a bunch of votes for Car of the Year last year for NACTOY.
Yeah, and it was the 25 North American Car of the Year for NACTOY. Mm-hmm. So it won. So clearly enough that our 50 journalists, enough of us thought that it was a decent car that it won that award. It was good. It was a really good car.
Yeah. All right. Another... EV battery story, but this is a positive one.
Yay!
So where's this? I'm trying to remember where this guy's from. He's in Santa Cruz, California. A guy named Dave Blankley. He bought a 2022 Mustang Mach-E to use for ride hailing. And in 3 years, he has managed to put 250,000 miles on this thing.
Wow. That's a lot of miles.
Yeah.
Wow.
I think it works out to somewhere around 300 miles a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year.
Wow. That guy works, man.
And he's charging this thing all the time. And so when they took it to the dealer, they checked it out. And this thing still has 92% of its original capacity. It'll still go over 290 miles on a charge, even after 250,000 miles.
That's incredible. That's a lot of money because it's a short, like that's all been done in a very short period of time. So it's neat to have that kind of figure on an EV. You'd have to wait a lot longer for a lot of people to ever hit, if they hit that kind of mileage, to still be 92. That's fantastic.
Yeah. And the standard battery warranty on this thing is 8 years or 100,000 miles. So he's still well within the 8 years, but he's gone a little over the mileage limit.
Just a skosh over the limit. He's getting no warranties for anything at this point.
some of the things he does, he does a fair amount of DC fast charging, but lots of level two charging. But he, except for if he needs to take a longer trip, he sets the charge limit at 90%, which is generally the thing to do if you're just driving it around day to day. Set the max charge to 90%. So there's less risk of overcharging.
Yeah.
Batteries tend to last a long time when you do that.
Yeah. He says he's charging it mostly home, except on his high mileage days. What counts as a high mileage day when you're putting that many miles on? He'll stop for like 15, 20 minutes to charge a DC fast charger. So I think the bulk of his charging is happening at home. And hey, he's using it the way you're supposed to, not charging to 100%. And it's holding up, sounds like, the way it's supposed to, and then some.
Yeah.
That's good news.
Yeah. With a gas car, after 250,000 miles, you're probably not going to have, you're certainly not going to have 90% of your original fuel economy, or probably 90% of your original power.
Right. And I think that's something that people don't think about with EVs. Like when you think about battery degradation and, I'm not going to get the range that I was getting when the thing was brand new after 5 years, you don't get any of the numbers that you got when your gas car was new either. Everything over time, you're getting worse fuel economy. Your power isn't what it was when you first bought it. So if your car if you think like, gosh, I've had my car a long time, it doesn't feel as powerful. It doesn't seem like it's getting the fuel economy. You're probably right. It's a slow thing. It shouldn't happen when your car's a year old or something. But over time, whether, the battery is going to not hold as much of a charge as it did in your EV, but your car isn't going to get the fuel economy or power that you once had in your gas car either. Just the function of things aging.
Yeah. So, for those that are avoiding buying an EV because you think, you're going to have the kind of experience you have with your smartphone where you've got to replace the battery after a couple of years or replace the phone after a couple of years because the battery no longer holds a charge. That's just, except for first generation Nissan Leafs, that's just not the case.
Yeah.
A lot of studies have shown that everything other than a Nissan Leaf typically loses about 1 to 1.5% of capacity per year for normal driving. So typically after 10 years, you're still going to have 85% to 90% of your original capacity. In some cases like this one, it's even better. EVs all have a minimum 8-year, 100,000-mile warranty on the batteries. Some, like the Hyundai Kia batteries, like our EV6, is 10 years, 100,000 miles. Within that time, if you've gotten down to 70% state of charge, they'll replace the battery. But they almost never have to do that.
Right. You got to figure, too, warranties are peace of mind for you, but they're not going to issue a warranty that they're not fairly confident that the car is going to outlive, So if you see that kind of warranty, you can have a pretty good feel that it's going to go longer than that before things go wrong.
Yep, exactly. Let's see what's next on the list. Oh, speaking of warranties and EVs, have you ever dropped your phone in water?
I have actually dropped my phone in water once or twice. It survived, but I did.
Have you ever taken it in for service and they stick a little thing in the holes
yes.
To look for the little sticker in there that indicates water exposure?
Yes. And thankfully, the times I've needed service, it had not been dropped in the water. So I passed.
Well, apparently, a lot of Tesla owners are not passing.
Did they drop their car in water?
Generally, when a vehicle is designed to operate in all kinds of conditions, like rain,
snow,
and so they're expected to be exposed to water. But apparently, according to this story from Jalopnik, it says in 2023, Tesla paid $1.23 billion in warranty claims, which is a 53% increase over 2022, and would have been, And then this year they're on, or last year they was $1.45 billion, which seems okay, given the number of vehicles on the road. And they have, 4-year, 50,000-mile bumper-to-bumper warranty, the same 8-year, 100,000 miles on the battery. However, apparently, a number of owners have been frustrated by what isn't covered by the warranty, which is water damage. Owners have complained that Tesla has refused to pay to replace their warrantied batteries because of evidence of water damage was found. Many of the owners claim that the only water exposure was due to rain. However, Tesla refused to budge, leaving its customers on the hook for battery replacement cost, which was roughly $21,000 in one case. Yeah.
That's weird. What part of your battery, would something have to be not sealed properly? Like, okay, let's say they haven't accidentally driven their car into a lake, right? So it's just normal water exposure like all vehicles get. What would it be, the batteries not sealed properly for the?
That's really the only thing it should be, yeah.
Wow. That would be a bummer.
Yeah, the batteries, when they manufacture the battery packs, they should be completely sealed, to prevent any water intrusion. If you've ever watched any teardowns of battery packs, you'll see that they tend to be rather difficult to open up,
right?
Because of all the sealant they put around the various parts. But apparently, some Tesla owners have been having issues with water intrusion and Tesla refusing to honor the warranty.
That's a stinker. Yeah, especially if your car hasn't been through water. I mean, if you were dumb and you drove through floods or drove through water, which, turn around, don't drown people, don't do that. Forget the warranty. Just don't drive through water that way. Like if there's a flood or something, don't do it. But it would be a bummer. I would be so angry. I'd be crankier than I am with my car. I'd be really ragey.
Well, one Model S owner says Tesla refused to pay for the $7,900 replacement of the rear drive unit, which is normally under warranty, because water was found in the high voltage harness cover. So the those big orange cables that you see on EVs and hybrids, they found water inside the casing, the insulation. So clearly, their seals were not working.
Right. That has to be what it is. It can't. Yeah.
Yeah.
Everybody's not randomly driving through a flood.
Yeah. And of course, we've heard the stories of Cybertruck owners whose vehicle's finish has been damaged just by going through a car wash. In the Cybertruck owner's manual, it talks about, not leaving it out in the rain, or making sure you dry it off right away. Otherwise,
it does not talk about rain. Oh, for the stainless steel staining. Yes.
Yeah.
Which is exactly what a car that I would want is one that I have to worry about the rain.
It says here in the if you have to take your Cybertruck through an automatic car wash, the manual lists several precautions. These include engaging car wash mode, avoiding hot water and detergents, and checking with the car wash staff to find out if the soap they use has a pH above 13, and then not washing it in direct sunlight. So, you know, if the soap has a high pH, it can damage the stainless steel finish. The car wash mode is interesting because the battery pack on that actually has some drains in the bottom of the pack. There's a gap at the bottom of the battery pack, which if there's any water intrusion, the water goes there and then it's supposed to drain out. And what they actually do in the car wash mode is there's an air compressor that will actually pump air into the battery pack to put positive pressure inside the battery pack to try to prevent water from coming up through those drain plugs.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's complicated.
It is.
It's definitely not a simple design.
No. All right, let's move on. Another Acura story.
Okay.
We talked about the Integra being the last car in the Acura lineup.
Yeah.
But this week, somebody bought an old Integra. What year was it? Integra 20, Type R.
What did it say? Wait a minute. I'm not seeing it. 2001.
2000. Yes. The 2001 Integra Type R.
Phoenix Yellow 2001. With 4,800 miles. Whoa, someone never drove that. Why would you not drive that when it was new? You know, that would have been so fun.
I wouldn't laugh at somebody paying, you know, $25,000-$30,000 for this car with that low mileage.
And
that's not what somebody paid on Bring a Trailer.
They paid just a little bit more than that. What did you say you think? What would you pay for this car? Say you were gonna buy this, Sam.
I think, you know, 30,000 seems reasonable.
Okay, that feels reasonable because it's not a car you find.
You know, a 25-year-old Integra.
How about $204,204?
No.
Yeah.
That's just stupid.
Someone paid that much money on Bring a Trailer. I mean, I'm not.
Those Integra Type R's were great cars. They were a lot of fun.
Mm-hmm. It was fun. But $204,204, and whoever you are, good for you that you spent a couple hundred grand on a car that you really want, but you really wanted this that bad? Must mean that there were a lot of people who wanted it that bad, right? If it got all the way up to that?
I guess, yeah.
Like a lot of people were fighting for it, or at least two girls, two humans, were fighting for it.
To get to 204,204.
I feel like that should be his license plate, 204-204. That's kind of a neat number.
Yeah. I mean, granted, you know, those Type Rs, the four-cylinder engine had an 8,400 RPM red line. I mean, you know, these were crazy revving engines. But, that's just too much.
It's just so perfect. There's a picture of the engine bay.
Yeah.
It's very pretty and perfect. It looks like a new car. Even the interior looks like a new car.
It does.
I mean, have fun with it, dude. Please. I hope they're not just leaving it in a garage somewhere. Like I just
probably
drive it and enjoy it. I mean, it's your car, do it, but drive it. Okay. I'm okay
so
now.
Did you ever get a chance to drive the current generation Supra that's just going out of production now?
I think I did at some point drive the Supra. Pretty sure I did.
Well, it's going away. It was built in partnership between Toyota and BMW on the platform of the BMW Z4.
Mm-hmm.
And it's, you know, it hasn't been hugely popular.
No.
I was kind of underwhelmed by it. The powertrain's great, you know, drives and handles great, but you know, the looks and you know, seeing out of it was challenging.
I have this memory of seeing out of it, that being like, where am I? Like it was, I do remember driving this. It was not, visibility was not great. It's not great.
Yeah.
But now we're not going to have to worry about because it's dead again.
Yeah. Well, Toyota is planning to build a sixth generation Supra.
yay, I guess, but like,
but
make it better.
They're not partner with BMW this time. They're going to build it. And I'm guessing it'll probably use the 2.4 liter turbo hybrid powertrain that they have in the Tacoma and the Land Cruiser and the 4Runner.
That could be incredibly fun in a tiny little car like the Supra.
Yeah. Let's see. Oh, so have you ever ridden on a Waymo?
I don't think that I have. What do we? We rode in a, what was the one that we did? The driverless car?
That was Cruise.
We rode in a Cruise. I think that's it. Just a Cruise.
Okay. So, you know, you spend a fair amount of time in Boston.
I have.
Do you think that vehicles like that, robo-taxis, could survive in Boston?
I think if you want to test to see if your vehicle can actually handle things, put it in Boston and see what happens and say a prayer before you say, I don't think it could. The problem, so Waymo wants to theoretically bring cars here. That's the story we're talking about, to Boston. It hasn't been axed. It hasn't been approved. There's just all sorts of discussion. Unsurprisingly, organizations like unions for taxi drivers and app drivers don't want it because it would take away for their business. A lot of people just don't want it in general. They don't feel like they're safe enough. And Waymo even admits, like someone said, well, what about winter weather? Because winter weather is bad enough. Winter weather in a city is its own special circle of hell because narrow roads get narrower. Parking spaces become harder and harder to get in and out of. Where there were 10, there's now 5 because snow takes up half the space. It's a really big challenge. And we even said, like, yeah, we're not sure how it would handle an extreme weather. But I love one of the comments, and I wasn't sure if it was this in another story that I saw because I read a lot about this since it's local. People are like, how are they ever going to handle how aggressive Boston drivers are? That to me is the part that I would be worried about, because I can tell you every warning system I have in every car I've ever driven when I'm driving in Boston is constantly yelling at me because it thinks I'm too close. I'm cutting someone off. I'm about to rear end someone. I'm like, no, this is just driving in Boston. Calm down, car. I don't think a self-driving car can handle it. Like, I don't see how the Waymo is going to handle it. We need to find someone who has a Tesla who's tried it.
Yeah, I haven't seen any videos of people trying FSD in Boston.
Like, not just driving on the highway. Like, get yourself down there by Faneuil Hall where there's a million tourists. See what happens.
Well, I've ridden through Fisherman's Wharf area in a Waymo, and it handled it just fine.
You know, did it?
All kinds of traffic and pedestrians around there, and it had no issue with it at all.
Yeah, they talked about that in the other. I mean, it's a challenging place to drive. So if it can navigate that, gold star to Waymo. But I get why people would be nervous about it, because we do have a lot of streets, too, that make absolutely no gosh darn sense whatsoever. Like, you come to an intersection, there's 6 different intersections coming, car, you know, lanes of travel coming in. And good luck figuring out when you have the right of way, you know, that kind of thing. But I feel like if they can... I feel like it would get approved. I mean, there's definitely benefits to having that for people who hate driving in the city.
Well, it sounds like a lot of the people in Boston City Council at a meeting this week were actually against it.
Yeah. Yeah. The city council was not really pro having these vehicles come in. So it doesn't have a lot of support because I think city council probably is against it because they have so many questions still. But so far, Waymo hasn't actually said, we are hoping to start testing whatever, you know, December 1st or something. They've just been doing a whole bunch of mapping, and the mapping they were doing was with drivers driven.
I was like, driven.
Manually driven. What's the word I'm looking for? How do I say that? Yeah. Not driverless, driver guided vehicles. So they haven't gotten to the point of saying, yeah, we want to try and launch this. So this is all sort of preliminary conversation about, like, what do we think? So Waymo hasn't answered a lot of those questions because Waymo isn't there yet either.
So it'll be interesting to see what happens there, and also in Manhattan, because they're doing mapping in Manhattan as well, and they would like to tap into that market.
Yeah,
you know, obviously a place like Manhattan. I don't know. I've only ever been into Boston once. I don't know how many people rely on taxis or ride hailing in Boston, but in in New York, you know, in Manhattan, a lot of people use taxis and ride hailing. And so that would be a huge market potentially for companies like Waymo.
Yeah, I think there's, I mean, there's a pretty good, you see a pretty good number of taxis and ride, more ride hailing services. I think those have gotten a huge chunk of Boston's services in that regard, but I have never looked at numbers. So it's just be like purely my random observations. There's still a number. I feel like you look at New York City and there's a million yellow taxis. I don't feel like it's like that in Boston, but they still have a good number of taxis and ride hailing services out there.
Okay. So one, you know, going back to EVs again, one more time, one of the challenges with EVs with range is, speed. You know, I mean, you know, we've all heard, we've talked about, you know, driving in really hot weather with the air conditioning on or cold weather with the heater on. But the thing that has the biggest impact on EV range is your speed.
Mm-hmm.
Because aerodynamic drag goes up exponentially with your speed. It goes up with the square of your velocity. So if you double your speed, you get four times as much aerodynamic drag. If you're taking a road trip, consider being a little more judicious with what speed you set your cruise control at.
The only really truly long road trip I did was several years back in an EV6. Mm-hmm. And when I did that from California to Florida, drive straight to see how it would work. And it was noticeable. Like, that was one of the biggest things we noticed when you... If you got too, you had to keep easing up. Like, if you got too heavy on the accelerator, even if anyone else around you is flying, and that's normally when you suddenly start speeding, right? Everybody else is going 80 and you're like, whoops, I'm matching the speed and that's way higher than the speed limit. But just dropping to hold right at the speed limit made a big difference. We could see it in the range that we were getting. So yeah, speed makes a huge difference.
Yeah. And even if you just drop to 75 or 70, that makes a big difference compared to 80 or 85.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're on a road trip and you're running low on range and you need to get to a charger, just drop your speed down. Yeah. And it'll make a huge difference.
Yeah,
you'll get a lot more range out of it. You know, it's better than getting stranded on the side of the road.
Exactly. So just slow it down a little bit and suddenly your range will get a little better. Might give you that little extra oomph that you need if somehow you've misjudged or something's gone wrong.
And finally, our friends at TFL bought another car. Have you ever driven a Dodge Viper?
I've never driven one. I've ridden in one.
We bought
that. Was the first time that I ever was on a track event was in a Dodge Viper at a Chrysler thing. And I forgot who it was. He drove me around in it in a hot lap and it was hilarious, but I've never driven one.
I have had the chance over the years to drive several different ones of different generations, including a first generation model, which to call it crude would be a bit of an understatement. So the guys at TFL bought a first generation Viper, a 1994 Dodge Viper, and they put up their first video. They're going to be doing a bunch of videos with this thing. They walked through some of the, features or lack thereof of the first generation Viper. When the Viper first appeared in 1989, at the Detroit Auto Show, when the Detroit Auto Show first became the North American International Auto Show, the star of the show that first year was the Dodge Viper concept, the original Viper concept. And at the time, they weren't planning on building it, but they got so much positive attention for this thing that Bob Lutz, who was running product development, he was the president of Chrysler at the time, wasn't the CEO, but he was the president, he said, we got to build this thing. And so they had to find a way to figure out how to pay for building this thing. And so what they did was they did it as cheap as they possibly could. Basically, the only thing they spent any significant amount of money on was developing the engine. Everything else,
good luck with that.
Wasn't absolutely necessary, wasn't there. Like, Windows? Who needs Windows?
Overrated. Overrated.
Door handles? Nah. Who needs door handles? Check out the link in the show notes. Watch the video that Tommy and Case did to introduce their new Viper. It's good fun.
I'm loving the first thing I noticed. I haven't watched the full video, but just looking at it, is that it had, that was an era when they were trying to figure out what to do to make you buckle your seatbelt. Remember, they were trying to make mm-hmm. you buckle it. And this,
yeah, because they had the first passive restraint law.
Right. And they have, but there's a weird, so to make sure you had your lap belt and your seat, everything, the seatbelt's on the door. It's like on the, it's attached to the door. So when you shut the door, the buckle is on the, you're pulling it on the door. So if you opened, I remember having these, if you managed to open the door with your seatbelt buckled, you were like, whoa, like it was this weird. It was weird.
Yeah, the intent was you were supposed to leave it buckled and just slide under the belts when you
didn't
got in
work that way. No, because when you did that, it was this giant seat belt like stretched in front of you. And if you had any, like if you're trying to put something in the car, heaven help you. If you're trying to put something in the car, like on the front seat, because you got your stupid seat belt in the way that then is in the way when you close the door and squishes whatever you have there. If you had like a plant or something. Oh, I hated those seat belts so much. Those are the ones that used to go across the track. On the
There were some that went up and down the A pillar.
Oh, that
and
was
then,
awful.
But the ones on the Viper, and there were some other cars as well that they were just static. They just mounted at the back edge of the door.
Yep.
And you just slide under them.
They stopped doing all that weirdness.
Yeah. So check out the video. It's good fun. All right. Let's answer a few questions.
Okay.
First up from Paul in BC, British Columbia. My niece and her husband, who live in British Columbia, are expecting their first child and decided it's time to replace their Honda Fit. They would like a small, affordable station wagon and don't want an SUV. Unfortunately, this eliminates the only wagon in their price range, the Outback. They're now looking at hatchbacks, specifically the Impreza and the Kona. Both strike me as too small for a baby seat and a Corgi in the back seat and miscellaneous baby gear in the hatch. I've suggested that they consider a Honda Civic hatchback hybrid as a roomier option. Which of these cars can best fit two adults, an infant, a Corgi, and gear? What other hatchbacks in the mid-30s, $30,000 US, should they consider? I think the Civic is a great option.
The Civic, I'm trying to think, is the Corolla any...
The Corolla hatchback is smaller. It's shorter than the sedan.
I was trying to remember the sizing.
And the back seat is quite tight.
Yeah.
I would actually take a look at the Kona. The second generation Kona is quite a bit roomier. Mm-hmm. And that one might be worth, try it out.
I think that's part of it. Like this is a tough one because it's the putting the kids in the back and wanting small. That can be a little bit of a challenge. Like the hatchback is a great, or the wagon is a great body style for a family like that. But you can.
I mean, the Corgi doesn't take up much room. I've got two of them. They fit in pretty much everything.
Yeah, the Corgi will make do. And really, as their new parents expecting their first child, even if they don't have the baby yet and they have the car seat, I'd highly recommend taking that car seat with them, brand spanking new, to the dealership and putting it in the car and seeing how it fits. I recommend that to parents that even have kids already and are looking at a new car, bring the car seats. Like if you can find the kids to stay at home, so you don't have to have them with you but bring the car seats, because the latch systems on some cars are easier to access than others. Getting more than one car seat is easier in some. So I think it's definitely worth bringing the car seat that they have before they even have the child and buy the car to the cars they want to try. And any dealership's going to let you plug that in and see how it works. They're going to let you do that. They want to sell a car. So yeah, I would say bring it and see how comfortable they are with it and how it fits. Maybe not so much dog, probably not going to let the dog in your car, but the dog will be fine. Make sure the car seat is easy for you to get in and out of whatever car you pick.
Another one I would take a look at is the, I don't know. It's not available yet. Is the, and I don't know what your timing is, but the Kia K4 hatchback is coming out soon. That one's a pretty good size that I think would be a good one to consider if the timing works for it. It says expected late 2025.
So that might be too late unless they are just pregnant. But yeah, that would be a good one.
Yeah. Let's see what else is out there.
It's probably going to be price-wise. It'll be too much. The price is the kicker.
Yeah.
Hatchbacks in the mid-30s. Unless they got a used vehicle, that would open up a little bit wider of a range of vehicles for them. Yeah, I
mean, a lightly used, something lightly used.
Yeah. That might not be a bad call. Because you know that they have a dog and they have a baby. That car is going to get trashed inside.
Yeah.
Like, they might not think so, but it is. So, used one.
But I would, like you said, Nicole, definitely take your infant car seat and take it to a bunch of dealers. Mm-hmm. Go to a Hyundai dealer, see if it fits in the back of the Kona. I know two corgis will definitely fit in the back seat of a Kona. So, you know, if you got one and a baby, you'd probably be okay.
I feel like you'd be okay. The baby gets one side, the dog gets the other.
There's also the new Nissan Kicks, mm-hmm. the second generation Kicks. That's a little bigger than the first gen.
Yeah.
That one, you know, starts around 23,000-24,000. So that's one to take a look at. What else is out there? Stellantis has no cars, except for the Charger.
Yeah.
GM has no cars except for the Cadillac CT5. Another one to take a look at, would be something like the Chevy Trax.
Oh, yeah, the Trax is a good little car.
Yeah, and, you know, very affordable,
mm-hmm.
At least for now, till the tariffs hit it. There's a few options out there. I think one of the smaller crossovers is probably going to be your best bet. Definitely take a look at the Trax, take a look at the Kona, and the Civic.
Yeah, I think those are good bets. They need to try out a few and see what they like and comfortable and fit that car seat for sure.
Yeah. And, you know, like the Civic has got plenty of room in the back for all of your baby detritus.
Mm-hmm.
So you can definitely fit all that stuff in there. Those are some options. All right. Next up, Frustrated Rick in Utah. Hey guys, listen every week. I was sorry to hear about Nicole's battery issues. Well, you'll be really sorry to hear today's show.
Yeah, it got worse. Frustrated Rick in Utah.
Here's my current battery issues and gripe. My Mach-E, which I absolutely love, has had 12-volt issues for 2.5 years. I've gotten warnings to check the 12-volt battery. Every time my dealer says everything's fine. 2 weeks ago, my Mach-E had an over-the-air update fail, and it had to be towed. Since then, my car failed to start twice. The last one, I had to have it towed. Now my dealership is telling me that it'll be $350 for the battery and $150 for diagnostics. That sounds bogus to me.
Because that shouldn't be happening.
Yeah, and especially this car is still under warranty.
Well, and you've reported it to them repeatedly. Like, mm-hmm. it's not like you... argument, Rick.
Unless you have also accumulated 250,000 miles on your car in 2.5 years, your car should still be under warranty, and you should not be getting charged for any of this.
Yeah, he says his question is, doesn't the onboard computer record all these warnings? Why am I responsible for Ford's inability to correct this problem? I understand batteries have wear and tear, but when there's a constant problem, why am I the beta tester? I feel you, Rick. It does record things, but it should record if you're having a problem. The trick, like I mentioned earlier in the podcast, it might say like 12-volt battery issue. It doesn't necessarily, isn't always clear where the why it's having a 12-volt battery issue. Is the battery just fail because the internal components of the battery went bad? Did the battery fail because some random module was staying on? Sometimes the codes don't tell the whole story, but if you're getting warnings, it should have recorded that. Now, I think they do clear out at a certain point, right, Sam? Don't they clear out?
It depends on the nature of the fault code that's detected. So some stuff, if it's intermittent, it may... You know, if the problem goes away and doesn't recur, it will clear those faults.
Mm-hmm.
Other things should stay, and it should be persistent.
And if you went into the dealer when you were having those warnings to have it checked, when you went into the dealer and they pulled the codes, they would have a record of the fact that they pulled the codes. Like they should have that you went in. And so there should be a record that you've been telling them for 2.5 years that you've been getting warnings. So
yeah,
I don't think you should be on the hook for this. And I would argue with your dealership a little bit over this issue.
The other thing you should probably do is call Ford customer service.
Absolutely.
And I'll put a link in the show notes, but it's ford.com/help/contact. And so you can, there's chat on there, there's social media channels, and there's also phone numbers that you can call, including one specifically for customer service issues.
I mean, and sometimes just in general, if you're having a hard time, anybody with the dealership, sometimes if you really feel like you're just being wronged, kind of, if you will look up whatever OEM's customer services at a corporate level instead of, you know, the official Ford or Jeep or Subaru or whoever customer service, once you get out of the dealership and you reach out to them, they'll sometimes be able to, if things are really not, you're not being treated right, they can sometimes right that wrong for you. So it's always worth a phone call, especially if you're looking at paying for something you don't think you should be paying for.
And the 12 volt problems on the Mach-E are, it's not an isolated problem to you. Mm-hmm. Ford has a current ongoing recall for that. So, you know, that's something that Ford should be covering. They should not be, the dealer should not be charging you for a battery.
Mm-mm.
Or for diagnostics.
No, because especially if it's a known issue, then it should just be like, yeah, you're having an issue that we know about. It's under warranty. There's a recall. We'll take care of this.
All right. Last question from our friend Sean Whitehurst. Hello, Wheel Bearings team. I'm a little behind in the podcast, but Ford should go with Maverick.
He made the EV and Maverick capitalized in his email.
Yeah. I'm setting myself up for a disaster if I buy an off-lease Mercedes EQS sedan. Or am I setting myself up for disaster if I buy an off-lease EQS sedan? They're in the 30s now.
Am I setting myself? I don't know. Disaster?
Yeah. No. I mean,
I would not have an issue with that.
Yeah. I mean, Mercedes has already taken the hit on the depreciation, so. You know, if they're willing to sell an off-lease car for, you know, $100,000 car for something in the $30,000 range, go for it.
Yeah,
it's a good car.
Yeah.
If you like the way it looks, and I mean, it drives well, it's got decent range, go for it.
And then he even says some background. I've always wanted an S-Class for the comfort. We currently have a 14 Nissan Leaf around town.
That would be quite a step up from a Leaf to an EQS.
Wow. We have a 24 Cadillac Lyriq on lease that ends this year. It's wonderfully comfortable and quiet, even in the base, which was discontinued, the tech trim. Since getting the Lyriq, I've driven in a current gas Escalade and gas 7 series. Neither of them seem significantly more comfortable and quiet than the Lyriq. I can get past looking at the EQS from the outside, but I'll go crazy if it has to routinely go to the dealers. I've always had incredibly reliable cars, Acura mainly, and have never really needed to replace major components on cars. Would buying an EQS require a relationship with a mechanic in deep pockets? And does air suspension still reliably fail from Mercedes? I haven't heard the air suspension issue of late. Have you heard that?
Not recently. Most of the modern air suspensions are a lot more robust.
Pretty good. Yeah.
Yeah.
I wouldn't have reservations about, I mean, that's in the 30s. I think I'd give it a go. Don't yell at me if it doesn't work out, but I would give it a go.
it's worth a shot. I mean, at that price point, you know, it's lost 70% of its original value already. Right? What do you got to lose?
Why not?
Yeah. So it says the guy who just bought a used EV a few weeks ago, and we'll see how that works out.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's it for this week. Thank you, everybody, for listening. And we'll be back next time.
Bye, everyone.